This is the state of things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. They can be good or evil, young or old, on two legs or four. Witches, wizards, and warlocks have a long history on the silver screen, and they blur the lines between the ordinary and the fantastic as they continue to capture the imagination of us mere mortals. For many years, Hollywood treated witchcraft and magic as mostly bad things, but blockbuster series like The Lord of the Rings and Harry Potter have helped the supernatural become more better reputed in our minds. Today on Movies on the Radio, we explore movies about witches, wizards, and warlocks, and we'll talk about the role religion, gender, and beauty have played in creating the image of witches on screen. Joining me, as always, to talk about this are our film experts Laura Boyes and Marcia Gordon. The enchanting Laura Boyes is film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art. Welcome, Laura.
Why, thank you, Frank.
And the ever-bewitching Marcia Gordon, a film professor at North Carolina State. Hi, Marcia.
Hello, Frank.
Good to have you. I suppose, since we're doing this kind of Halloween theme, I should probably do this in, you know, in costume.
I think you should.
Okay.
I don't think we have a choice.
You know, the problem is going to be hearing. Put on the mask, this kind of devil mask,
wow,
which is gorgeous. I have to take my headphones off.
But it was really not meant for radio.
It was not meant for radio, though the face might be. which, you know, this is a construct, of course, that has been in stories and myth forever and ever, and then it makes its way to the screen. How do you think, give us a kind of the scope of Hollywood's treatment. I'll start with you, Laura.
Going back even farther, the whole idea of witchcraft, fear of women's power, fear of women's sexuality, fear of their ability to create babies, which seemed rather mysterious for so many centuries. So that fear turns into looking at witches as something evil.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the 1920s, internationally speaking, that was really the decade where you see a fascination with the supernatural coming forth, especially out of European cinema. And so in 1922, there's a film called Hexen that comes out of Sweden that is about witchcraft and witch hunting, and it's about religion and mental disturbance and all of these things. And I think even though there's a fine line between witchcraftery and what happens in this film, I was thinking about The Passion of Joan of Arc from 1928, which is just an extraordinary film by Carl Theodore Dreyer about Joan of Arc, who has these holy visions and is eventually burned at the stake. So not a witch per se, but a woman with these kind of notions that fall outside of the scope of normality, and she's treated in a witchly fashion. So we begin to get these really terrifying visual representations of women in particular who have these powers and what happens.
And it seems to me it's two strands somewhat separate at the beginning that become entwined toward the middle of the 20th century. One is the fear of women, this longstanding fear of women, their power, not only their this mystical power to actually bring life into the world, but then the power they might exert over men, and men's fear that this will then somehow turn them crazy and cause them to lose their inheritance or whatever. That's one strand. The other one, though, turn of the 20th century, this clash of cultures, the old world versus this new future upon which we embark, and how they clash, the science fiction of a future that could look very much like the mystical, magical past, coming together kind of in that quintessential moment.
And I think one of the things that we'll see today, and that, you know, even the films that we're not going to get to talk about, is there's also this fascination with an old concept like witchery, which has these ties in American culture, of course, to kind of 17th century and Salem witch trials and all of these things somehow coexisting in the modern world, and what would happen if indeed those at least imagined practices carried forth into, say, 20th century American life. And sometimes that's treated very comedically, and sometimes it's treated very seriously.
Because, of course, pagan religions predated Christianity, but Christianity co-opted many of the beliefs of pagan religions. So there's always the fear that that old power will resurface within your modern new religiosity.
And one of the things that we're going to find as we go through this hour is the ways in which, the many different ways, apropos of what you just said, Laura, that witchcraft and magic is treated, sometimes comedically, sometimes romantically, other times horrifically, and sometimes a kind of morality play, as The Wizard of Oz was. That was your pick, Marcia, tell us more about why you chose The Wizard of Oz.
Well, so nobody had responded to this call with The Wizard of Oz, which I thought was really curious because to me that's the first thing I think about with witches. Because I guess in truth you have three witches in the film, although two are really playing the significant roles in the film, and I find them to be really, really interesting characters. On the one hand, absolutely this film is buying into the good witch, bad witch, beautiful witch, ugly witch, but they're actually pretty active, engaging characters, I think, especially in relationship to Dorothy, who's a little doe-eyed and helpless throughout the film. But
well, you say there's one of each, of course, the good witch, Glinda, and then quite obviously and most famously, I think more famously, the more more memorably, was the bad witch.
Give me back my slippers. I'm the only one that knows how to use them. They're no use to you. Give them back to me. Give them back.
Keep tight inside of them. Their magic must be very powerful, or she wouldn't want them so badly.
You stay out of this, Glinda, or I'll fix you as well.
Oh, rubbish. You have no power here. Be gone before somebody drops a house on you too.
Very well. I'll bide my time. And as for you, my fine lady, it's true, I can't attend you here and now as I'd like. But just try to stay out of my way. Just try. I'll get you, my pretty, and your little dog too.
From the 1939 classic, The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, and so, of course, the Wicked Witch of the West is echoes of the mean, nasty neighbor who wants to kill Toto for tearing up her yard. And so she comes to Dorothy as this enemy in the wizard, in this alternative universe. And let us not forget, too, that we have a wizard in this film, a wizard who has actually no powers, who's kind of creating, fabricating all of this. So this film in some ways encapsulates wizards and witches. But I think just in terms of thinking about the memorability of this film, I was terrified as a kid of the Wicked Witch of the West and the flying monkeys in particular. And I was fascinated by the magical Glinda. I mean, it's the film doesn't give us any other options. One is hideous and evil, and one is good and worshipped. And so that's kind of the dichotomy that we get a lot in these films.
Yeah.
Well, the dichotomy is the beautiful, sexually desirable woman contrasted with the postmenopausal woman who has no longer any function except apparently to do evil. So,
and she's the one we remember. And as remarkable as it is to have a good witch, right? That should be the thing. Well, wow, there are good witches. Never thought of that. Why wouldn't I carry that forward? But now your little dog too.
Well, because the power of age and knowledge is itself a threat.
And, you know, think about what happens to her at the end of the film and that so memorable line, I'm melting, you know, that you can also, you know, undo them and banish them.
That's right. It has a happy ending. There is a no.
Or does it?
We are talking on Movies on the Radio today on The State of Things. Laura Boies and Marcia Gordon. And we have another pick from a listener who chose this film as their favorite.
This is Jerry Batchelor from Cary, North Carolina, and the movie I am proposing is Bell, Book, and Candle with Jimmy Stewart and Kim Novak. And I've loved this movie for years. It's much more a romantic comedy than it is a magic-driven or Halloween-type movie. Some of the reasons that I have loved it so much are the cast. It is a wild cast, one of the few movies that Ernie Kovacs ever made. Jack Lemmon is in the movie, and for me, having Elsa Lancaster and Hermione Gingold in there too just sort of pulled the whole thing together. Jimmy Stewart gets a love potion that he wants to get out of, and he gets some help. And one of the funniest scenes to me is where he has to drink an antidote to cancel the potion, and the difficulty he has putting that to his lips. It is an off color and obviously smells terrible. And then he has to take a drink.
Of course, I imagine it'll be a little strange at first because it, well, you know, it'd be sort of like somebody reading over your shoulder all the time. But, you know, I think I'm allergic to your cat. If it was anybody else but Merle, of course, I'd be scared stiff. You know, it's getting late. I think maybe I'd better go up. And thank you for the drink.
I've never watched that without just gut-wrenching laughter.
Bellbook Candle.
Well, this is everything that the caller said, but it's also something else because John Van Druten, the author, was gay, and all of the witches are a metaphor for the gay population of New York living their secret lives with their secret nightclubs, running art galleries, being musicians and artists. And if you watch the movie with that in mind, you can see that all of the dialogue has a completely mirrored meaning.
So Jimmy Stewart's on the DL.
Right? No, but Kim Novak is coming over to pitch for the other side.
Yeah, and well, we're going to talk more about that as we continue our conversation on movies on the radio, Wizards, Witches, and Warlocks, about this sort of the underground theme and what you have to do with your power when you're not accepted by the dominant culture. Marcia Gordon, film professor at North Carolina State. Laura Boyes, film curator at North Carolina Museum of Art. We'll dig into some of the most haunting depictions of witches, wizards, and warlocks on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacia with Movies on the Radio today, talking about witches and wizards on the screen in your nightmares as well. Joining me in the studio, Marcia Gordon and Laura Boyes. Marcia is the film professor, well, a film professor at North Carolina State. Laura is the film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art. And I want to pull up a clip now from a film that actually none of our listeners called in, but, well, I guess there's a whole lot of films that you would come to mind. Didn't get called in, but this is one of them, I Married a Witch.
Don't ever jam your brakes on like that.
I didn't jam them, it just stopped. I can't figure it out.
Hey, what's that smoke?
What happened to him?
Who?
The fellow we pulled out of the fire. He's gone.
How do you like my body, Jennifer? Not too old, not too young. I'm sorry I've forgotten the formula for clothing. I had to borrow this sheet from the amulet. By the by, has the potion been administered?
Yes. Father, something went wrong with our plan.
What? But that love filter never fails.
It didn't. But I drank it.
Nicodemus. Then you love him?
Yes, Father. But he's about to marry someone else because of my ancient curse on the Woolies.
Do you think if I explained it all to him?
By all means, do. Telling a mortal you're a witch will only mean the end of you.
Then what shall I do? He must not marry her.
You won't let him, will you?
Let me think.
You could make him love me. You can do anything you want.
Here. This problem should be fairly simple. Just leave it all to me.
Here's a clip from the 1942 romantic comedy I Married a Witch, starring Frederick March and Veronica Lake.
Yeah, this, I can honestly say, is one of the weirdest films that was ever made in Hollywood, and that is saying something. But as with Bell Book and Candle, there's a little bit of a Pinocchio kind of story here, which is that the witch potentially loses her powers by actually falling in love. And so in this case, this is an old curse that Veronica Lake and her father have put on this family who burned them at the stake in the 17th century Puritan family. And they are now going to come back and haunt men by making them fall in love with women, making bad object choices. And she trips up along the way. And there's long conversations where Lake and her father are just smoke talking to each other for like extended sequences. I mean, this is really one of the most unusual films I have ever seen. And partly this is because it was directed by René Clair, who was a French filmmaker with roots in experimental cinema. And so I would just encourage anyone looking for a very strange watch to look at this 1942 film.
Yes, he was a surrealist, really. And Veronica Lake, who is delectable in this movie, falls in love with an incredibly stuffy and annoying Frederick March, It is ever so in Hollywood. We need some magic to undo that. And it's of course, the basis for Bewitched, of course, which was adapted from.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Apart from the weirdness of it, and Frederick March at one point is actually addressing the fog, her as fog. And
yes.
She's saying, well, I don't have any clothes on. He's saying, well, we can. He's looking at this fog. Then finally up to his room. But that's the theme I wanted to talk a little bit more about, this idea that the choice is for the woman to give up your powers and have a normal life with a stuffy man, or keep your powers and go on, you know.
Yeah, and in this case, I think it's pretty interesting because unlike Bell, Book, and Candle, where the Kim Novak witch doesn't really have any malicious intention, except, I guess, to steal this man away from another woman who she thinks is a bad object choice. In this film, these are mischievous and vengeful witches who are trying to exert revenge, but then they're undermined by this, I guess, pathetic.
Well, they're mad about the Puritans, and who isn't?
I'm still a little hot about that. Put on my conical hat and make a little mayhem. And also, her father again plays a role, so that if anybody's going to fix it, it's Dad. So
right.
that's a little part of this.
And he can't.
Let's move on a little bit to the horror hotel.
Hi, my name is Ann Weber. I'm calling from Asheville, North Carolina. My pick is a movie that came out in 1960. In Britain, called City of the Dead. It was released a year later in the United States as Horror Hotel. I saw it on Shock Theater a few years later, fall of 1966, when I was babysitting and watching somebody else's television late at night. Very moody, creepy film about a witch's coven or an immortality Satan-worshipping cult in a New England town. Christopher Lee plays a devil-worshipping professor of history who encourages one of his lovely students to go research witchcraft in this little village. One of the characters who struck me for very different reasons from horror was the character of an old reverend of the church with no congregation, very lonely man whom no one listens to.
For 200 years, the people of Whitewood have carried out rituals that mock the church's teaching.
I find it very hard to believe, sir.
Do not doubt, my son. It is real enough. For years, I struggled against the witches. Their master took away my sight.
Seems incredible.
I have tried to convince others. They too found it unbelievable. But I know these people have a pact with the devil to worship him and do his works.
Ann Weber calling in with her pick, the 1960 horror thriller City of the Dead, also known as Horror Hotel. And again, this is one of those themes where it's a clash of cultures, the power of the old culture and its ways to keep us grounded in the fear that these kind of new ways are going to bring us nothing but evil.
Well, and a number of these films talk about the insularity of the small town as being inherently evil, that you know everybody and you're all in on the same secrets, and outsiders are not welcome.
And it's interesting that in the two, the 40s and 50s Hollywood films that we've talked about, that gets altered significantly, that it's not this kind of creepy rural experience where it's, you know, the church and then the coven, but rather it's either kind of urbanized or in a much more kind of city setting.
And in this case, it was the fact that this rural culture was about to flip, that it was seeing, you know, sort of had something in common with the urban professor, the sort of intellectual, the ways that would lead to the path of evil if we didn't stay entrenched in our cultural
traditions.
Because
knowledge in these films is considered to be evil. It's kind of flipped, you know, evil knowledge, but really it's knowledge is evil.
How about The Night of the Eagle? Let's listen.
This is James Coley in Chapel Hill. The film Night of the Eagle from 1962, which was later retitled Burn, Witch, Burn, was based on the novel Conjure Wife by Fritz Lieber. And one thing that's interesting about Night of the Eagle is how it compares to other movies and to the television series Bewitched in the depictions of the relationship between the witch and her human mortal husband or boyfriend. You know, in Bewitched, which was, of course, a light romantic comedy, the underlying premise was that in order to marry Darren and live among the mortals, Samantha had to promise to give up her powers. But she does this out of love and uses her witchcraft anyway when the situation requires it. An obvious feminist interpretation, which I don't necessarily agree with, is that marriage means women must give up their power or what makes them the special individuals they are. And there are similar themes in I Married a Witch from 1942 with Veronica Lake and Frederick March, and in Bell Book and Candle from 1958 with Kim Novak and Jimmy Stewart, which are also romantic comedies. But in Night of the Eagle, there's another married couple where the man is immortal and the wife is a witch, whose story is anything but a light romantic comedy.
Why does it upset you so much to think that there's such a thing in this world as witchcraft? It's one of the oldest religions in the world. It just depends on what you believe in.
There's an explanation for everything.
Oh, really? Such tenacity. Any theory, however improbable, wild, and coincidental, so long as it fits into your tidy view of things.
What are you doing?
What about the accident with the truck, Norman?
What truck?
Yes, isn't it odd that I should know about it? How does your Aristotelian mind account for that?
It would be ridiculous. The papers could have got hold of it.
They didn't.
The 1962 British-American horror film Night of the Eagle.
Well, I actually have not seen that film, but I wanted to speak to the kind of Bewitched comment because I remember growing up watching that television show and just how much more interesting the witches were and how much more, that world seemed fascinating, whereas Darren just seemed like such a loser. And just it's a pretty interesting premise to have this this kind of sacrificial idea. But the whole premise of the television show is that you want the witch to work. The witchcraft.
Right, right.
That's
right.
What
and they do
for.
Deliberately make these men to be, you know, so nothing that you would ever want to be, right? And he's constantly losing. Darren's losing the account or just on the threshold of losing the account.
And she has to have a great dinner, you know, so that everyone will be happy and he won't lose his job.
Exactly. And it's not menacing at all. I mean, that threat is, it's a threat to his masculinity. It's not a threat in the way that it sounds like Night of the Eagle or Burn Witch Burn, which is such a great title, is obviously on a different scale.
Yeah, very much so. And it is kind of a thrilling ending that is horrific in many ways, or certainly would have looked that way back then. So it does. It's not a rom-com by any means. And it's very creepy all the way through. And then there's this film, which I actually remember seeing in the theater when it came out. And it was one of the creepiest films, certainly, that I had ever seen.
My name is John Blanken. I'm calling from Raleigh. And my favorite film about witchcraft is Rosemary's Baby. There are no broomsticks, no cauldrons, no cackles or warts. Just a few nosy, slightly obnoxious, and overbearing Upper West Side Manhattanites determined to bring the Antichrist into the world.
What have you done to him, you maniac?
Satan is his father, not Guy. He came up from hell and begat a son of mortal woman.
Hail Satan!
Hail Satan!
Satan is his father, and his name is Adrian. He shall overthrow the mighty and lay waste their temples. He shall redeem the despised and wreak vengeance in the name of the burned and the tortured. Hail Adrian!
Hail Adrian!
Hail Satan! Hail Satan!
He chose you out of all the world, out of all the women in the whole world. He chose you. He arranged things because he wanted you to be the mother of his only living son.
His power is stronger than stronger. His might shall last longer than longer.
Yes, Satan!
No! It can't be! No!
Oh, look at his hands.
And his feet.
Oh, God!
The movie's, I think, 50 years old now, and I think I can still see the pipe smoke in the living room where Roman Castevet and Guy Woodhouse are discussing just how much control Rosemary should have over her own reproduction.
Mm. And you remember the scene where they showed the Satan's hands. He had small hands, don't you think, in the movie, and in Rosemary's Baby.
I mean, this is just a perfect film for what it is. I mean, it does the most extraordinary job of navigating this strange universe with these performances by Mia Farrow and John Cassavetes that are just haunting. And the idea of being possessed, I mean, nobody mentioned The Exorcist, but whenever I think of Rosemary's Baby, I also think of that, very different kinds of possession. But these 60s and 70s films were so terrifying. I mean, and still are terrifying to watch. And so I think in this case, Polanski really captured the horror of the idea that this could be in the world and you could be surrounded and literally taken over by it.
It is so, so scary. And part of what's scary about is as she's pregnant, she gets sicker and sicker and sicker. And when I was pregnant, I was sick every single day of my pregnancy. And every single day I thought about Rosemary's Baby.
You didn't eat raw liver, did you?
Did not
that
eat raw liver.
Spook-
did not eat those health drinks. But of course, now one of the most striking things is that you would need a very powerful magic spell to be able to afford an apartment in the Dakota.
There's that. Well, and I think some genius, too, in just depicting the banality of evil, which was one of the main themes and that our listener talked about, the genius of sort of doing that and not making it, but you have to do both. You have to terrify me and, you know.
Because living in an apartment, you have such intimacy with people that you basically don't know. And so it's always kind of mysterious and threatening. And you have to, you know, think about what's going on, and you encounter people in the halls or in the elevator, and who are these people?
Right, and you may have your theories, but you feel crazy for having them.
Right.
That's
exactly.
Part of the horror is that exactly. All the things you imagine are, you know, then ultimately are actually affirmed. As...
That's right, with this little Lucifer and its small hands in the cradle. Let me ask you this. It's funny because when this came up, it had been a long time since I thought about this film. My question is this considered a great film still?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think, I can't imagine it not being in many a lover of horror films' top 10 lists, because it's the perfect kind of horror, which is it's not a chainsaw.
Horror.
It's not, you know, jump screaming kind of horror. It is this kind of psychological horror that then gets manifest in these external ways.
It ages really, really well. It doesn't seem dated.
We're talking movies on the radio today on The State of Things. Laura Boyes, Marcia Gordon with me. And our next pick is a film that I was not familiar with before this. Let's listen.
My name is Sarah Bell, and I'm calling from Henderson, North Carolina. And the film that I want to talk about is The Wicker Man from 1973. It's a movie that stays with you for a really long time. It's one of those films that I immediately thought of when I heard the call for a film about witches, because it comes across as something completely different than what it turns out to be. And the vibe is very cheery, small Scottish island, remote little island, picturesque and quaint, with lots of cheery townspeople with rosy cheeks, but behaving very strangely.
What is it? What's wrong, sister?
How to get burned?
That, my friend, is your destiny.
It is your destiny.
Back up!
You will sit beside the gods and goddesses for all of eternity.
Back up! I swear to God, I will shoot you!
And there are other things about it that are amazing. Like, it celebrates this kind of pagan freedom, and comparing that to repressed Christian sexuality. And really, there's a lot more going on than you think maybe when you first see it.
Wicker Man, 1973.
And it seems to me that there's so many of these films where Christianity and Catholicism, in the case of Rosemary's Baby and The Exorcist, right, mm-hmm. are the kind of foil to, and usually not particularly victorious foils.
Yeah.
And so it seems to me that there's something going on. I'm no expert in this, but with these films thinking about the kind of status of religion and the status of this kind of belief in the occult at their kind of various moments.
Well, it's because you trip into the land of the supernatural, and once you're there, you notice that religion is there with you, right?
Right, and often it's the wizard in The Wizard of Oz, which is something with absolutely no power and no traction, no ability to actually do anything, but scares the hell out of people and makes them behave well until they realize that there is no wizard.
Yeah, and this is also a film, The Wicker Man, that is a film about human sacrifice. Nicolas Cage does a lot of shouting in this film, just to point that
this,
out.
Well, so there's two versions of this film, and that would be the contemporary version.
Oh, yeah. We probably got the wrong clip. That would be my fault. I picked it.
Yeah.
I got the, but that one showed up
first. Blame
it
on the guy with the mask.
The guy, with the devil mask.
Yes.
How do they compare? Do you know?
I do not know. I did not see the most recent Wicker Man.
See the most recent one. Well, I will tell you, Nicolas Cage does a lot of shouting.
He
in
does.
That film.
Okay, good. Good.
Well, that would not be unusual.
So here's the good news. Now I don't have to see it.
My guests are Marcia Gordon, film professor at North Carolina State. Now I'm really curious about the 1973 version. Laura Boies is film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art, and we are talking movies on the radio, Wizards, Wizards, Witchers,
and
those who possess the mouths of hosts. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacia with Movies on the Radio, Witches, Wizards, Warlocks today. Marcia Gordon, Laura Boies, Frank Stacia. Marcia is the... I didn't want to make you a witch and a wizard.
I
thought I got to include myself in there. Otherwise, people would say, do you know what you said about your guests?
I know.
And then I'd have to answer
it's
that
all
email.
True.
Here's one from the 1980s that blends, you know, old school magic and chivalry in the same film.
My name is John Munson. I'm calling from Raleigh, North Carolina, and I'd like to talk about the movie Dragon Slayer. It came out in 1981, and it was a co-production of Walt Disney and Paramount Pictures, and it's a great dragon film with a fantastic wizard played by Ralph Richardson. He plays a shabby wizard named Ulrich, and you see in Richardson's performance, you can see the seeds of what Ian McKellen used to play Gandalf in the Lord of the Rings films. But it's a great period piece. It's taken place in England, sort of in the Saxon period, after the Romans have left and before the Norman invasion. And it's very gritty and dirty, and it seems very real. It sort of gets away from that shiny, happy Hollywood look.
Now be it known throughout the kingdom that this maiden, having lawfully been chosen by a deed of fortune and destiny, shall hereby give up her life for the greater good of our land. By this act shall be satisfied the powers that dwell underground
and the spirits
that attend them. In gratitude for this sacrifice, His Majesty declares the family ploughman to be free of obligations for a period not to exceed 5 years.
That's from the 1981 film Dragon Slayer, a film that was nominated for 2 Oscars. And again, I think it's that kind of mashup where you get to put the best of all worlds. You get the dragons in there. We'll get a little bit of saving the damsel in distress and, you know, magic.
The whole Arthurian thing, which really has influenced so many movies.
Yep.
Right, and resonates with so many people. But I just want to, this listening to that clip and thinking about the film made me think of someone who we haven't mentioned, who's Georges Méliès, who was a turn of the last century French filmmaker who really kind of pioneered imagining otherworldly things. Trip to the Moon is probably the most famous film where you imagine moon creatures and, you know, destroying them or whatever. But that idea that film can imagine and present us these very unreal worlds in as real a way as is possible, because it is does not have to, you know, bend to reality. And that's and Dragon Slayer offers that kind of mystical universe.
Well, and the psychological part of it is, which is sort of unlocking the magic within, which has been a kind of a deep psychiatric, psychological theme, you know, sort of how much are we repressing ourselves, getting back to some of even the films of the 40s and 50s.
You know? And we'd love to see what they can do. And that's part of the fun of watching these films, is getting to see the witches perform their magic, even if they are, you know, bad or evil witches.
And for the most part, the magic and witchcraft of the early and central, you know, the middle kind of 20th century did seem to be bad stuff. And then as we get into the 2000s, the modern age, witchcraft takes a turn and it starts looking a little better. Let's start with the comedy, The Worst Witch.
I am Sarah Fuller, and I'm calling from Carrboro, North Carolina. And I wanted to talk about The Worst Witch. It's a movie that I first saw as a little girl. It was actually a made-for-TV movie that never saw the theaters, surprisingly. But a lot of people did end up seeing it. And The Worst Witch stars Tim Curry, of course, from Rocky Horror Picture Show, and Charlotte Ray from The Facts of Life. And the main character is Bruza Bach, and she just sort of has all of these fumbles, and but she has a good heart, and she's not that great of a witch.
I think we're going to have problems with that one.
And which one?
Mildred Hubble.
Ethel Hallow is now a frog.
You must be the worst witch in the entire school.
It's turning pink.
Once in a purple moon,
there is a special young witch who shines above the rest. Come, Mildred.
It's just a really good underdog story and has great songs. The song by Tim Curry, he's the only male in the movie. He has a song called Anything Can Happen on Halloween.
Anything can happen on Halloween. Your dog could turn into a cat. There may be a toad in your bass guitar, or your sister could turn into a bat. Christmas time brings the snow. Summer time brings the sun. But on Halloween, your blood begins to run.
A frog in your bass guitar.
I am all in with this movie. I've never heard of it. In fact, I watched an episode on Netflix last night of the remake of it, which has some of the same dialogue, but seems a lot more candy-colored, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, that it sounds like an 80s time capsule. I have not seen it either, but I am now officially obsessed with that song, so thank you, Sarah, for doing that to me.
We'll play it one more time before the show is finished. Sarah Fuller, who also pointed out that this is a film in 1986, a TV series in 1986, but it has many of the elements that you will recognize from Harry Potter, a school for witchcraft, you know, of bumbling and fumbling.
But it also sounds, and again, I haven't seen it, but it also sounds like it's really human. This idea of like a fallible, it's not like some super powerful witch, that it's,
because they're children.
Yes.
Well, there's some kind of teenage adolescent behavior too. So there's kind of the nasty, you know, prodigies who are looking down on our poor little witch, and they have cliques and all that kind of thing. So there's a lot of adolescent high school-ish, you know, themes that go on as well. And I think if you think about adolescence as that time when the magic of your body starts to change, you know, it's,
well,
kind of cool.
And also that, I mean, I don't know about anyone else, but I remember playing with the Ouija board as a kid and you know, wanting so badly for it, and then getting really scared if it ever seemed to be doing something that I didn't think I was controlling. So I think I think a lot of us have that fascination with possibly tapping into those powers at a time when we feel powerless and we want to be able to control our worlds, and we look at people who can in the movies and we go, oh, that would be pretty cool if I could just blink and make that happen.
Which is segues beautifully into The Craft, which is my pick here.
You're welcome.
Let's listen.
You're going to kill yourself tonight, my dear.
No, I'm not.
Surprise.
Oh.
Really? Look in your eyes tells me you might not be so sure. After all, you have every reason in the world to do it.
I mean, you killed Chris, and you killed your mom.
You killed your mom and you're coming out of her. Now that is really special. Even I couldn't go that low. Bravo!
Stop it, please!
What's the deal? Why doesn't she use magic on us?
Because she's weak! Weak, weak, weak.
Oh, God, you're so disgusting. Now is the end. Let her go in peace. Now is the end. Let her go in peace. Now is the end.
Woo, 1996 American horror film, The Craft.
So this has become kind of a cult movie for millennials. My daughter just went to a screening at the Alamo Draft House in Brooklyn, where people were given rubber snakes and electric candles as in a Rocky Horror Picture Show type situation. It's about high school misfits. You know, this fear of adolescent sexuality kind of plays into this. And they get into magic, which they use to extract revenge on people who've wronged them, the boy who assaulted them, the girl who's a racist, an abusive stepfather. And the person who really sells it is Firouza Balk. And was she in The Worst Witch, too? I think the caller said she was, but she was the little Dorothy in that scary, scary Return to Oz. And Firouza Balk is so magnificent. She's totally unhinged in this movie as the witch who really taps into her evil side.
And,
it's very fun.
And this is a film that you watch, so it can't be that scary.
That's right.
No, but I will,
but actually, there was a part that I had to close my eyes because it's still in the age of practical effects, and they filled up a house with snakes and roaches and spiders and all of that. So,
well, I tell you, the producer for this segment, Laura Pelliser, says that this is the film that absolutely traumatized her for life.
Wow.
Well, it's and because of that.
We've been wondering what that was, and now we know.
At least you have an answer.
and it's so wonderful because at one point someone is cautions these girls, watch out for the weird. And Fairuza Balk looks him in the eye and says, "We are the weirdos." So it's a way of owning that.
It's kind of interesting to think about a film like that in relation to, I was immediately thinking of like Heathers and Mean Girls. And
that's exactly
well, and
like
Carrie,
that.
Right?
Exactly
and
like that.
Right,
yes.
The Carrie's the franchise.
It's,
that
it's Mean
that
Girls
stuff.
And Heathers with witchcraft.
Yeah. So then again, the sort of the yin and yang, the Jungian ideas about magic. Lord of the Rings would capture some of this.
Hi, my name is Nancy McLean. I live in Raleigh. My pick for the best movie for this particular series is Lord of the Rings. I think that the wizards are definitely good or evil or powerful or whatever. There's not a female witch in it. Galadriel is the only one who comes close to being swept away by the power of the ring.
I will give you the one ring. You offer it to me freely. I do not deny that my heart has greatly desired this. In place of a dark lord, you would have a queen! Not dark, but beautiful and terrible as the lord!
But she changes back and says that this could not be something that she could do. And I think that's one of the things that Tolkien does when he's writing. He seems incapable of writing a female character who is evil.
Lord of the Rings, on the state of things. And there's a film. Well, so there we go. I mean,
Lord of the Rings is just something that I could never get into. It's like anything that you need a map to tell you where you are, I
loved
kind of get lost.
Those. I mean, reading as a kid, that was a very important literary precedent to me. But I mean, the one thing I will say when I think about films like Lord of the Rings and Harry Potter is that because of the time in which these films were made, I mean, just visually, you can be so kind of mystified and kind of seduced by the imagination of wizardry and witchery. And that's such a different experience than when you watch something like The Wizard of Oz. The fascination, of course, that was a imagining Technicolor to use a kind of in this innovative way for the world of the witches. And so I guess there's always been a desire to kind of show the otherworldly with kind of technology. But I mean, you just can't imagine the kind of the effects that they use in these films now in the context of films made 50 years ago that are relatively so primitive, like fog in bottles talking to each other, like in I Married a Witch.
Well, it's movie magic.
It's movie magic.
Movie magic that we talk about on Movies on the Radio today on The State of Things with Laura Boyes and Marcia Gordon. The other thing about it, too, is, again, I think this reflects a more mature understanding of power. And it's interesting that the series and as a literary work, this is done decades earlier.
Right.
And it's out there. And it's out there for the making for decades. But I don't think it's until we come to a more mature understanding of what it is about power that scares us and how we could possibly embrace it and then allow ourselves to let go of it. But you've got to go through the whole process of accepting it, taking it on, and letting it go. I don't think that we were ready for even those themes, at least not in movie land, until that film came out.
That's really interesting.
It is interesting, and nothing that really anybody shares with me. They really just like the fact that a lot of people got killed in that movie. And Harry Potter. Did you mention Harry Potter?
My name is Michi, and I'm calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. And my favorite witches, wizards, or warlocks movie is Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. What I liked very much about this movie in particular is the alternate universe that was created and how magical it was. When you watch the movie, you just feel so surrounded by it. I love the excitement that Harry feels and that all the watchers feel while watching the movie, and you see the people flying by, and you see owls, and you see toads, and you see brooms.
Good afternoon, class. Welcome to your first flying lesson. Stick your right hand over the broom and say up.
Up.
Wow. Mr. Longbottom, exactly where do you think you're going?
Do you really have the scar? Wicked.
Mr. Potter, our new celebrity.
First years should note that the Dark Forest is strictly forbidden, that no magic's to be used between the classes and the corridors.
Petrificus Totalus.
The third floor corridor is out of bounds to everyone who does not wish to suffer a most painful death.
That was from a film called Harry Potter.
I've never heard of that one.
I've actually never seen any of them, but I have heard of them, of course.
Well, the thing about
chat about them
that is Harry Potter is like a Cinderella story. You know, he was sleeping under the stairs and he was being horribly mistreated, and then he turned out he was special after all. It's like when you're a kid and you think, well, maybe these aren't really my parents, and there's somebody much more exciting that can direct me toward a delightful future.
But it seems to me, too, bigger picture-wise, thinking about the incredible popularity of Harry Potter and Lord of the Rings, and then also just as a kind of bridge to all the superhero films which are kind of incessantly coming out right now, there seems to be kind of something in the air where we want to see these characters that are not of this world, that have these extraordinary powers that for good and for evil, and hopefully the good wins out over the evil. But it strikes me that there's something going on with a kind of anxiety about where we are with our ability to control the world.
Yeah, control or let go or acknowledge. Yeah, I think some of that's happening. And I think there's been a change in the way we reflect it.
It's the flirting with authoritarianism, that it seems so enticing that someone will really know what's good for you and can make everything all better. But the flip side of that is that that person does not know that at all. It is, in fact, evil.
That never happened. Next time, let's talk about cartoons.
That sounds great.
Let's do animation as we talk about it in the adult world. But it's really cartoons. We want kids to participate. But I have to say bye to Marsha Gordon and Laura Boyce because I'm running out of time. And this is Movies on the Radio. Thank you so much for listening to our program on the State of Things, produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton, Norman, Laura Pelliser, and Jennifer Brooklyn. Robin Copley is our technical director. You can find out all about us on the web, stateofthings.org, and find out more about our next Movies on the Radio. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio.